In a dank and run-down palace, a place where great glory had visited and moved on, a sad and dejected emperor sat on his throne without any audience. He wasn't just a prisoner of irrelevance. He was also chained to his failures. A small group of people in Jamaica had even called him the returned Jesus, and his own people in the proudly uncolonized Ethiopia had called him King of Kings. But now, not even he believed that. That evening, as he retired to bed, nobody, not even he, knew it would be his last. Despite all the promise and privilege he could once claim, Haile Selassie was strangled in his bed. The murderers buried him under a concrete slab in the palace, and it took 20 years for the world to discover the truth of his ignominious end. Bob Marley would write songs about him. He would become venerated as a god by the Rastafarians, but the real story of his life was much more tragic. Welcome to episode 3 of Blind History Season 8 with Gareth Cliff and Anthony Medera. We're thrilled to be able to bring you all the stories of amazing people throughout the years. And obviously, there's an endless supply of tremendous people. This guy comes from Africa, and today we'll get into his story in just a second. So if you're interested particularly in the history of Ethiopia, I think you'll be fascinated by his story. All right, Ant, so Haile Selassie, Emperor of Ethiopia. And it all sounds very grand. He claimed descent from King Solomon of the Bible and the Queen of Sheba. Do you remember her? There was a story in the Bible about how she came to visit King Solomon, and it was all this grand affair. He claims he's descended from both of them.
Yeah, so Haile Selassie is, you know, I found a very interesting individual. He actually brought Ethiopia out into, to be, you know, they would have just been another, I suppose, nondescript country, but he brought it right to the forefront, especially in the 60s, actually a little bit earlier in some of the, what transpired. And I found, you know, one of the great, people to talk about it from the 20th century.
Sure. I think it's worth also mentioning he was raised in fair luxury in Ethiopia. Ethiopia, by the way, the only African country that was never colonized. So it was the only country that maintained its independence from ancient times. You remember the Egyptians used to talk about Numidia or Nubia, and the people of Nubia, we assume to have been the original Ethiopians. So, I mean, we're talking about 3,000-4,000 years of history. Correct. In that country. He spoke Amharic, French, English, and he believed from a young age he was destined for greatness, and he was very easily encouraged by flattery and by all kinds of prophecies. But he did become regent of Ethiopia back in 1916 after the Empress Zauditu was installed. And wielded real power. And then, of course, he started introducing, and because Ethiopia had to modernize, he introduced all kinds of Western-style reforms, schools and railways and a new constitution. But he really only did that stuff superficially. Ethiopia was a very backward place at the time.
Correct. That's correct. But I just wanted to step back for a minute to, just so maybe we can all understand Ethiopia at the time. So there was a conference called the Berlin Conference that Otto von Bismarck, another upstanding individual, a Prussian emperor, he said, look, we are all trying to colonize that continent down on the bottom there, and we're all quite keen, but let's try not fight each other. So we have the conference, and we come up with a couple of critical points. So I think practically you need to prove that you'd colonized, number one, and number two, prove that you actually had a treaty with that particular country. So before you go charging off into Africa, and by that, then nobody else, another other country, large nation, will then dispute your claim. And so what basically transpired after that was a mad rush. It was almost like they said the conference is over and they're all charged out the door. And within a decade, Africa was taken up. But as you rightly said, there were a few countries that didn't get taken up. And funny enough, the Zulu nation, there was a battle before anything could be done with them. They were a very, and then in Ndebele as well, that was another one, and then Libya and then Ethiopia. So understanding that there was a mad rush, and then, but so the Italians were very keen, sorry to drag this on, but the Italians were very keen. And this is what elevated Ethiopia was, at the time, Menelik II was the ruling monarch, the emperor. He was a good guy. They revered him in Ethiopia. And he actually, the Italians thought, this is going to be very easy. We're going to just flatten them and take over. This is going to be a colony for us. This is the 1894. And subsequently, it was actually Menelik and the Ethiopians that flattened the Italians. And they went off with their tail between their legs. So why we have that, that's the precursor to say, to bring us to that situation where Ethiopia correctly is sovereign on its own. And the people around the world took notice and said, wow, this country can stand with all of us. You know, obviously the poor countries in the rest of the countries in Africa had first of all been smashed by slavery. And then the colonization, they went to the leaders, offered them all sorts of gifts. And then it just created a diabolical situation for everybody else. But Ethiopia stood tall. And I think that brings us, I think, a little bit into where Haile Selassie will later on fit in.
Yeah, I want you to explain this idea of Rastafari, because that's what he called himself, right? And he was crowned. I mean, if you talk about this coronation, it was quite an event. It was like a global media spectacle when really media was still in its infancy. It was covered by Time magazine at the time. Foreign dignitaries went. He was crowned King of Kings, Lord of Lords, conquering Lion of Judah. He was given 7 crowns during his coronation and gold robes. And he claimed to be the 225th monarch in an unbroken line all the way from Solomon. There was no credible evidence, it has to be said, about any of that. Mm-hmm. And it sparked the birth of Rastafarianism. Now, what is Rastafari? Can you tell me?
So first of all, what I can understand is regent. And he was appointed regent at the time. And he was, and Tafari was his family name. So there, if you put those two, just simplistically, you put those together and you have Rastafari. But they, where does Jamaica fit in? So how does this all piece together?
Yeah.
So there was a political activist by the name of Marcus Garvey. And he started talking about, because with the slaves, all the slaves being sent out from Africa to the Americas, he said, look, there's going to be a rise of the new Messiah that's going to come, or the Messiah is coming. And he will be from Africa, and the fact that they weren't colonialized was already a major thing at the time that he brought up this this belief. Rastafari, or later became Haile Selassie, or Haile Selassie, he started hitting the straps. So this was just a little bit before he was appointed king, and he was already regent to the emperor. And right, effectively ruling Ethiopia and refusing to bow down to the large nations. And so Marcus Garvey said, this is the new Messiah. And so he ended up having two roles, and he never denied it, Gareth. He didn't poo-poo it. He went with it. And I think to this day, so he was probably murdered at the age of 93, I think. But he was never... he's been immortalized, and even his palace is, you can go on pilgrimage to his palace to have, you know, to see the roots of Rastafarianism. And Bob Marley spoke about him, sang about him. It was a dual, almost like a dual life. You know, it's another life for him completely.
I mean, we've spoken in Blind History about Roman emperors who declared themselves gods and all the rest of it, but this is kind of odd, because you're not going to say no when people do declare you a living god, like Marcus Garvey did in this case. But he didn't exactly deny it either. He didn't say, listen, this is not true. You guys should stop worshiping me in Jamaica. So I think it must have been pretty confusing. All right, so we come to World War II, and we talk about Mussolini, and you mentioned Italy already. So they invaded in 1935, so before World War II had properly broken out. And Selassie's army was completely unprepared, and they were still using spears, like outdated rifles. The Italians came in and pretty much made a meal of Ethiopia. And he made a big speech in 1936 from the League of Nations denouncing fascism. It was one of the first times that anyone had done that. It was prophetic, but it was probably mostly ignored by people outside of, you know, Ethiopia and the people who were worshiping him in Jamaica. But during exile, and at this point, I think he was in England, where he lived in an English mansion and he had a piano and a butler. He lived a very decent life while he was there. But he became a symbol, really, of anti-colonial resistance. So you've got the actual man who had some power in Ethiopia before he was deposed. Then you got the guy who's considered a god by people in Jamaica. And then you've got this anti-colonial symbol that he became. I mean, it's quite a lot for one man to have.
Yeah, so correctly, he went into exile. I think finally, look, the Italians had a grudge. You know, they were really smacked in 1894 in that big war. And he was actually around at that time, funny enough. He was young, but when the war took place. But Mussolini, he really wanted to give it to them, you know, and effectively they took it. But so he was in exile, I think, Gareth, for 5 years. And he G'd up exactly what you said for anti-colonialism. He stood for so many ideals, etc. And so outwardly, they would think, you know, this great man, when he gets back to Ethiopia, I mean, it's going to be one of the great countries of the world, very advanced, modern. But you mentioned a bit earlier that actually on the ground, he was actually very feudal still, so with his own court. So you wouldn't necessarily see that. But in the 60s, he was seen as an enlightened man, you know, just a modern day ruler, and I think all of these things play into it. The Rastafarianism, that speech of the League of Nations. I think he really had a great way with all these great people in history, great orator, and he managed to bring that across. But we also know that by 1970. The famine. I mean, some of those frightening pictures we have of the famine in Ethiopia in 1917, this was happening all the time. So it wasn't unusual to see telephone poles and communication systems around Addis Ababa, but nothing anywhere else. Nobody really knew about, they knew about that they had, in a word, a great leader, but they still were listening to their tribe, and their tribe was against another tribe. So it was extremely feudal and awkward. And so he was operating on two planes, Gareth, I believe.
He was, and we don't want to skirt past this, because he was reinstalled as monarch in 1941 after the Italians were defeated in East Africa. I heard from my mother the other day that my grandfather actually flew Haile Selassie back into Ethiopia when he was taken back as king, which I didn't know until just 5 days ago. I mentioned that I'd be recording this, and she told me. So he was actually the pilot that brought him back into Ethiopia. There was a restored monarchy. Yeah?
Yeah, the reception that he got at that time was incredible. And what he was very clever on doing was he would always invite these international dignitaries, and they loved to be on the red carpet with him because he said the right stuff.
Yeah. Oh, yes, absolutely. He also hosted the founding of the Organization of African Unity, which is now the AU, but that started in Addis Ababa all those years ago. And he had good ties with the West and emerging African states. A lot of them were coming out of colonialization into independence, hosting their first ever elections. And he was kind of a symbol again of a wise elder statesman for so many people. But he was weird. Mm-hmm. I mean, he had a miniature lapdog called Lulu, who he gave a diplomatic passport to. And Lulu would sit next to him at all his state functions. He loved being photographed in military uniforms with medals that he'd given himself, a bit like Idi Amin later on. He created an entire cult of personality. So he put his image on, as many monarchs do, stamps, coins, textbooks. He was called the father of all, the elected of God. You know, these are not small claims.
No, and he also had a pride of lions, I believe, that used to operate around the palace. So, yeah, he was special. I mean, you know, maybe it was a bit odd.
Very odd.
But, you know, Lulu was famous. Sorry, Lulu was famous, Gareth.
Also, he had dozens of children, lots of mistresses, and he used to live in pomp and luxury, gold thrones and all the rest of it. But most of his people were in absolute poverty. Eventually, I think we've got to skip. That's right, the lowest GDP per capita, and you mentioned the starvation already. But there was a 1960 coup, which was attempted by his own imperial guard. He ignored this famine that you spoke of. And of course, he also started making some friends with some pretty awful people. But he was deposed in 1974 by some Marxists in a bloodless coup. He was arrested. He was held in his own palace and then quietly killed in 1975. He was either smothered or strangled. We're not sure how.
Yeah, and I think so. He was always quite he was a slight, frail person, even when he was young. So maybe it wasn't a massive battle to smother him, but correct, Gareth, they probably put him, you know, they probably killed him, but they also buried him under some floorboards. You know, the Marxists are quite good at doing these type of things, and so there wasn't any ceremonies or anything like that. He just disappeared, and life moves on. And but they've subsequently now removed and put it, you know, he's now been buried at his, that they had a bigger ceremony, etc. And he's more acknowledged, and the immortality still stands with the Rastafarian.
Yeah, it's so weird. And he never even, correct me if I'm wrong, but he never even went to Jamaica. He'd never been there. He was not interested in Jamaica at all. I think he touched down there for 8 hours in 1966. He never supported his own supporters, the Rastafarians. He never kind of sent them money or aid or help or a kind word. He just kind of ignored them.
Yeah, I think that's correct. I think he did, like you mentioned, he did touch down there. But they had a massive drought in Jamaica. And at the time of his coronation, his main coronation, when finally that the empress passed away, he was then at the big appointment where you said there was a lavish ceremony, and then it started raining in Jamaica, and so it's a holiday, it's a public holiday in Jamaica now that they've since that day that they I think it's the grounded day or something to that effect, and so it started to rain.
I mean, in the end, how would you account for this life? Because he was born, you know, into a family that would ultimately hold power. Whether he used that power or not, what's your opinion? He used it to for good or for bad?
So, firstly, I think that he used it to create this image. So he what he was quite good at was marketing himself, I think, and. But if we had to look at this, it's clear that Ethiopia at the time, I think after the Second World War, I mean, Ethiopia was sliding down constantly. You know, it takes a while to get to the ruin that it was in the early 70s. And so, you know, he was a monarch, you know, not dissimilar to some of the nut jobs we've spoken about. Yeah. I really don't. You know, what is his legacy? If he had to take a picture of Ethiopia in 1974 and what his legacy was, then I don't think we can talk too much about the constitution he wrote. You know, he wrote the constitution and he basically kidnapped his cabinet and made them stay in Addis Ababa for the year to make sure that they could get things done. So he, you know, just personally, I'm not a big fan of the people that say one thing and then under, you know, behind closed doors, They are completely different. And I think he was a bit like that. But, you know, I've just cursory looked at him. So that's just my opinion.
I still think, I mean, you know, we often look for like wacky nut jobs. And here on our own continent of Africa, we've got a lot of them to choose from. We've already highlighted Idi Amin, now Haile Selassie. There's that brilliant Monty Python sketch where they are serving, I don't know, it's a meal of some kind. And the guy goes, I'd like mine Haile Selassie. The other guy goes, no, I'll just have a medium Selassie, please.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, so well done Haile Selassie.
We will bring you another episode of Blind History. Episode number 4 is on the way. Make sure you like and subscribe and tell all your friends about it so we can do a whole lot more of these, because I think we have as much fun as I hope you have by listening and watching the episodes. Thank you very much, Ant. We will see you for the next one.
Look forward to it.